You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Jennifer Ackerman has been writing about science and nature for more than 30 years. She's the author of The Genius of Birds, which was a best nonfiction book of 2016 by the Wall Street Journal, and The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think, which was a finalist for the Penn E.O. Wilson Literary Science Writing Award. Her new book is What an Owl Knows. Thank you for joining me, Jennifer.
Oh, it's a delight to be here, Rick. Thanks for having me.
What drew you to owls out of all the birds that you have studied to focus in on that one sort of bird to devote an entire book to it? And what made you think you could fill a book with it when you filled a book with it writing about all birds?
Yes, well, it's true. I love birds, you know, all birds, but owls are just so intriguing, and they're so unusual in the bird world. You know, they're night hunters. They have this incredible quiet flight and these extraordinary senses that allow them to pinpoint their prey in the dark. You know, they have great vision in dim light, and they have really extraordinary hearing. And also, you know, we humans have been obsessed with owls for literally tens of thousands of years. And so I really got interested in when I started to think about, you know, writing about a book about owls. They just made my head kind of buzz with questions. You know, what is it that actually makes an owl? And how do these birds get to be the way they are? They're so different from other birds. And why are they active at night? And, you know, they have this reputation for the wise old owl, but are they in fact smart birds, you know? And I wanted to really explore these questions and find out, well, what do we actually know about owls? And it turns out that we know quite a lot. We've been studying them for a very long time, and the science of owls is just vast and fascinating. But there's really only lately been, I would say, some of the advances that are some of the technological breakthroughs that are necessary to solve some of the mysteries that have been around for literally centuries. So it made it a really good time to write the book.
You know, one of the things that I like about your books is your sense of telling a story, because on one hand, this is a whole book that focuses in on owls. On the other hand, it's a collection of stories about the people who study owls. And how do you approach this in terms of writing? Do you do all the taught interviews with all the people and do all that research first and then gather it into a book? Or does the writing of the book unfold along with the research?
Well, I would say it's more of the latter. You know, I spend a lot of time with the bird experts that I write about. So I go out into the field. I spend time with, in this case, with some of the best owl experts in the world, you know, studying owls in places like Montana and Europe, Brazil. And you know, these are people just utterly dedicated to their work, and they're really, really generous with their time. They take me out into the field, let me traipse around behind them, and they show me what it is they do every day and what it takes to study these creatures. They're not easy to study. And when I get a field experience like that, I usually try to write it up pretty quickly while it's fresh, while all the, you know, the setting and the conversations with people are fresh in my mind. So I'll write up chunks of the book, and while I'm out there in the field or soon after I come back, but then it's a different exercise to sit down with all this material that I have, both from the field work, but also from my own reading and research and other conversations, interviews that I've had with people, and I put it all together in in a narrative and you know, try to weave things together and juxtapose things that are interesting. And it's one of the the facets or the phases of the book that I really enjoy most. It's that weaving together the material and to make it, you know, readable and accessible and, you know, not overwhelming with information, but enough there really to suggest some of the deeper science.
Well, one thing that you're so adept at is keeping the pages turning and suggesting what you want to find out and then saying this person has some insight into that, and then talking with that person and growing the story. It's really a compelling page turner, which is, it's just fascinating. It goes from one subject to the next. And it's also, you talk about specific owls that you've met. And later on, we're going to play some sounds of those very specific owls that are online. It's a fascinating world. And I think also, too, one thing you do in all of your books is and I'm wondering whether you try to do this or not, is that by the time a reader is done finishes one of your books, that reader has a seriously different perception of the everyday world around them. I mean, after seeing the bird, reading the Bird Way and the Genius of Birds, what I previously thought of was something like large flying insects or flying rats became this whole, like, you know, alien species that with all sorts of amazing behavior. And this is the same way with this book, too, as you read about owls and also to the people who study them. It really changes your perception of the world. Is that something that happens to you and you try to convey, or is that just a massively beneficent byproduct of the reading process?
No, it is, you know, every book is a journey for me. And I always, you know, I start in one place and I end in a very different place. And I think what happens along the way is that my wonder just expands and grows. And so does my awe. And as I learn more about the birds themselves, the owls themselves in this case, and also the people who dedicate their lives to studying them, it really does shift my perspective in such a profound way. I come to think of these, at least over the course of the owl book, I came to think of owls as really these very subtle, very skilled, very intelligent, idiosyncratic creatures that that are very sophisticated in their communication abilities. They have these very nuanced social lives. So my attitude toward the birds themselves definitely shifts. And then there are these people that I meet who are just so incredibly dedicated. Two people come to mind. One of them is a heart surgeon. He's retired now, but even while he was still a practicing heart surgeon, he got interested in volunteering to study northern pygmy owls in Montana with owl expert Denver Holt. And now he's one of the world's foremost experts on the courtship and mating and raising of young in the northern pygmy owl. And he loved the contrast between what it was like in the world of surgery. It was so sterile, so predictable. Everything had to be in its place. And then he'd go out in the wild and he would get, you know, his hands would get bloodied from the owl's talons, and he would, you know, he'd get muddy and wet. And he just loved it. He loved that contrast. And it made me really see this kind of wildlife study in an entirely different light. And then there was
the appropriately named Steve Hero.
Yes, he is totally a hero. And as is Julie Kosmarsik. So she's the coordinator of the emergency room in a major hospital. So all day long, she's dealing with, you know, trauma, medical emergencies. And then at night, she heads out to band northern saw-whet owls. And she spends sometimes all night doing this, you know, banding these adorable tiny little owls. And she's contributing to the studies on how these owls migrate and how they use their habitat. But she'll spend all night in the field working with these owls. And then she goes back to her day job in the emergency room. And I sort of asked her, how can you do this? And why do you do it? And she said that owls absolutely, she said, they're not an antidote to the trauma she experiences, but they're an absolute restorative presence for her in her life. They really, on really bad days, she'll say to her fellow bander, you know, I could really use an owl tonight. And she really means that. It really changes her spirit in some fundamental way. So that I found just absolutely marvelous and shows us the capacity of wild creatures to really affect our souls and our well-being.
You know, that's one of the things too that came out from the bird way and the genius of birds is that birds are a lot smarter than I ever gave them credit for. They show equal and sometimes more intellect than the mammals we surround ourselves with and the mammals we in fact are.
Yes. It's one of the big lessons of the last decade, I would say. You know, we used to think that owls had, birds of all kinds, you know, that they had brains that were so small and primitive, they were really capable of only the simplest mental processes. Now we understand that birds have brains that are wired differently than ours are. We have our neurons are organized into kind of layers, like a lasagna, I like to say. And birds, they have their neurons are arranged in more like a head of garlic, into sort of bulbs or cloves of a garlic. But they have an amazing density of neurons in their brains. Their brains are super efficient, so they're actually punching way above their weight. So, you know, a bird's brain may be small overall, but it really is capable of very sophisticated mental capacities. And that's true for birds across the board, and certainly including owls.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned is that the technology to study owls has just really in the last few years come into itself. So talk about some of the technologies that have changed have transformed our understanding of what an owl knows.
Yes. First of all, I will say owls are really harder to find and to study than other birds. You know, they're extremely well camouflaged. They're active at a time of day when it's often difficult to access field sites. You know, they often live in very remote areas. So they're very, very hard to study. But we've got some new tools now, which are really helping us. And I like to call them sort of eyes in the field. They're things like infrared cameras that allow us to see what's going on with owls at night. Also drones to explore remote owl habitats. We have nest cams that are giving us a kind of 24/7 view of the intimate interactions of owls at the nest. And also satellite transmitters that we can actually put on the backs of the bigger owls to study their movements over short and long distances. And all of the new understanding kind of gleaned from these new technologies, along with, I would say insights from researchers who have been doing the very long-term studies for a very long time, those are combining really to shed light on and illuminate some of the really fascinating aspects of owl behavior and biology.
One of the things you talk about is how difficult owls are to find, or how difficult it is to find where they hang out. And one of the technologies you mentioned using is not high tech, but smell tech. It's dogs.
I was absolutely fascinated by this. And I talked to several people who actually train dogs to sniff out the pellets that an owl ejects. So let me just explain what a pellet is first. Owls often eat their prey whole, and there are lots of indigestible bits of it. So that you've got fur and claws and feathers and all kinds of things and teeth that an owl can't digest. So what happens is that those indigestible parts are compressed in an owl's stomach. And then eventually the owl moves this sort of compressed pellet. It looks like a big fat cigar, you know, packed full of all kinds of things. And it moves up the esophagus, and then the owl ejects it as a pellet. Now, these pellets, they have different aromas that we can't necessarily smell, but dogs can. So there's a wonderful group in Australia called the Difficult Bird Research Group. And this group, they study very difficult birds that are hard to study. But they've trained dogs to sniff out the pellets of Tasmanian masked owls, which are very hard to find. And the dogs can actually distinguish between the pellets of different species of owls. So they're trained to detect just the Tasmanian masked owl pellet, and they will go into large areas and track down the roosting sites of these owls. So their pellets all over the roosting sites. And then the researchers can come in with the dogs and just look up in the trees, and then they'll see the owls there if they're lucky.
You mentioned earlier one researcher, and I love the stories of the people and the way they kind of weave in and out of the narrative of the whole book and draw it together. This isn't just a book about the owl species, it's about the human species who study the owls. I love Denver Holt, and I was just this morning looking at the website at the Owl Research Center, ORI, and he's a very interesting fellow. So talk about meeting him and, you know, getting access to his world and his worldview, which is, I think, so interesting.
It really is. And, you know, he's one. When I started this book, I already knew a lot of ornithologists because of the other bird books I had done. And when I decided to write about owls, I started to ask around, you know, who's the person I should speak with? And Denver Holt's name came up again and again and again. He's just the owl guy. He has been studying there. So there are 15 species of owls in Montana, around the Charlo area where the Owl Research Institute is that he founded. And
I might mention it's near Flathead Lake, where the Flathead Lake Monster lives.
Right, exactly. So Denver has been conducting long-term studies on the many species of owls that breed in that area. And he's been going on, you know, 35 years with some of these species. And he's so knowledgeable and so dedicated and so intrepid. He's the guy that climbs the ladder to the tippy top of an aspen tree to try to position a camera so that it's focused on a tiny little hole that is an actual pygmy owl nest inside that hole. And woodpeckers drill the hole and then the pygmy owls nest inside. So he's up at the top of this ladder, you know, that just swaying back and forth. And, you know, he's not a young guy, but he's just completely fearless. He also spends a lot of time in the Arctic studying snowy owls and under very difficult conditions, you know, slogging through the tundra sometimes and searching for snowy owl nests, sometimes getting attacked by the snowy owls because they're very protective of their nests. And when Denver goes in to band the chicks, both the male and the female snowy owls will come after him. And he has some serious holes, certainly in his clothing and scars on his body from being attacked by these birds.
You know, one of the things I thought was most interesting was, you know, that, and you mentioned this, talked about the owl's nests. Owls do not build nests, which is against all our understanding of bird behavior, and they just use whatever they can find, although sometimes they decorate the nests. Do we understand why that owls diverge so much from other birds in this degree?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, for one thing, it saves time and energy. So the different kinds of species, they basically commandeer or use the structures of other animals. So I have, for instance, a big owl, like a great horned owl, will use the stick nest of a raven or a hawk. The little owls, as I mentioned, like the northern pygmy owl, the elf owl, flammulated owl, those tiny little birds, you know, about the size of a pine cone, they often nest in the holes that are drilled by woodpeckers in aspen trees and other trees. And burrowing owls, which are owls that nest underground, actually use the burrows of prairie dogs, skunks, badgers, armadillos, you know, anything that digs its own burrow. These little owls nest in those burrows. And, you know, you mentioned that there are some owls that actually decorate their nests. This is the habit of the burrowing owl. And it was one of the more delightful discoveries in the book, was that these little owls, they dedicate a lot of energy to decorating the nest, and they'll bring in all kinds of stuff, you know, corn cobs and little bits of wood and sometimes bits of fabric. David Johnson, who studies these birds, has actually looked at the preferences, color preferences of burrowing owls, and he found that they actually like red and white swatches of fabric better than blue and green. So they'll bring things in and they spread them out around the mouth of the burrow. And anybody who knows about the bowerbirds of New Guinea and Australia knows that those birds actually collect objects to draw in a female, to woo a female and impress her. Well, that's not what's going on here. These little male owls only start to decorate after their mate has begun laying her eggs. So what he's doing is saying to other male owls, okay, you know, my female's in there, she's on her eggs, this is my spot, you know, I own this place, look at all this stuff I collected. You know, what David Johnson said to me was, you know, if you want to be a tough guy in the world of burrowing owls, you decorate your home. So,
you know, even though those owls are tiny, all owls are raptors. They are predators, and serious predators, punching above their weight. And when you see something like, you describe owls that are as big as fire hydrants, that's a big bird.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a Blakiston's fish owl. And that's a bird that actually hunts for fish. The Eurasian eagle owl is another very big bird. And it can take prey as big as a small roe deer or a young sheep. They're really remarkable. Some of the, you know, owls are called wolves of the sky, and it's really for a very good reason. I remember meeting my first powerful owl in Australia. It was in the Botanic Gardens in Sydney. This is a bird that eats possums, which are, you know, very big mammals, really. And a powerful owl can easily eat about 350 possums a year. So it's like almost one a day of these very, very large mammals. They're just incredible hunters. And the smaller ones, you know, they take all kinds of small mammals and also insects. They have a pretty diverse diet. And other birds. And the big owls will eat the little owls. So it's quite a rough game out there.
You described the great gray owl hunting, and it does something that's utterly remarkable. And that this has to do with the way its brain translates sound. So talk about what it does that's just so remarkable.
Yeah, so the great gray owl, just picture this, you know, it's up in a tree and it's night, it's dark. And it can detect the sound of a vole or a mouse just rustling under, tunneling under a foot and a half of snow, you know, some great distance from where it is perched on the tree. And what the owl does is it, you can see its head swivels toward the sound. It has this facial disc that's flat, and it's almost like a feathered satellite dish. It collects sound and it channels it toward the ears. So you see the bird swivel its head to toward the sound, and then it goes over, hovers above the where the sound is coming from, and then it just plunges straight down and nails this prey, you know, that's under 18 inches of snow. It's really amazing. It's just remarkable. And lots of owls, different kinds of owls, hunt this way by sound, and they hunt in the pitch dark.
And owls' ears are very unusual. My ears are approximately the same size, and on opposite sides of my head. Owls, not so much.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. You know, people actually often mistake the little plumicorns that you see sometimes at the top of like a great horned owl or a long-eared owl. Those are primarily for camouflage. They have nothing to do with hearing. That the actual ears of an owl are just holes in the size of its head, and they're covered with specialized feathers that actually allow sound to pass through. But it's what's inside those holes. It's just amazing. These birds have an auditory system that's been called the race car or the Ferrari of sound sensitivity, because they're so keen and really superb listeners. They have the hearing organ in the brain of an owl, the cochlea, is absolutely enormous, and it is easily three or four times the size of the cochlea of other birds. And this is what gives a bird like the barn owl a kind of sensitivity of hearing that's nearly unequaled in the animal world.
You know, too, the way birds use sound, you describe them as using advanced math to calculate out. Birds, if you would have told me 5 years ago that birds do math, I would just say that's like a science fiction novel.
Well, it's a little bit, so it's their auditory neurons that are actually doing the math. They do an amazing job. Those auditory neurons receive information and transmit it, they're actually adding and multiplying the incoming signals, and they're averaging them. It's an amazing kind of mathematical capacity that it's actually happening at the neuronal level. And all this calculating happens, you know, in just the blink of an eye, but it allows them to localize the sounds that they're hearing and pinpoint them in three-dimensional space.
You know, also, one of the things that is really interesting about owls is their feathers, the way their feathers are adapted. It's kind of astonishing. It's, again, like no other bird. So describe what that adaptation is.
Yeah, so it's one of the things that really allows them to be such skilled hunters. They have this very quiet flight. So it allows them to do two things: to approach their prey without the prey hearing it, but also to hear the noises that any prey is making. It's really one of the great wonders of the bird world, I think, this very quiet flight. And they really, so most birds, when they fly, they make a lot of noise. And there are different ways that noise happens when a bird flies. First of all, there's air flowing over the wing surface that produces turbulence, and it's kind of air eddies that make noise. And also, a bird's feathers, usually when they rub together, they rustle and they whoosh and they rasp against each other. They make a lot of noise. Owl wings are just different. They have this wonderful row of, it's called a comb. It's kind of hair-like bristles at the front edge of their wing. And when it meets the oncoming air, the serrations, those little bristles, they break up the turbulence so that there's no swoosh sound when an owl flaps its wings. And then there's this soft layer of velvet that coats the whole wing, and that quiets any rubbing together noise that the feathers might make. And these features are really so brilliant at quieting sound that designers, technological designers, they've used them to model noise reducing structures in all kinds of technology, like wind turbine blades and Japan's bullet trains, airplanes. Quite amazing.
And the fellow who dug up this information is Chris Clark. So talk a little bit about, you know, what impels somebody to pursue that route of science. It's not like you're trying to figure out the wonder drug to connect to fix some weird disease or something. This is just really, it's science for the love of science and understanding.
Absolutely. It's really born of curiosity, I think. And Chris Clark made a discovery about hummingbirds that's sort of the opposite of the owl, which is that the hummingbirds make, some hummingbirds, they, when they're courting, they make a very interesting sound at the, they do this kind of U-shaped dive, and at the nadir of their dive, they make this very unusual sound. Chris Clark figured out that it was their feather. They make it with their feathers. And so he got very interested in studying this. And I said, how are they making this sound, and why are they making it? And is it to impress the female? And then he thought, you know, it's really interesting how feathers make sound. It's also really interesting how they don't make sound in an owl. So he wanted to explore, you know, what are and really take a deep dive into the features of feathers that quiet them, and, you know, what an owl is actually hearing of its own flight. So he's designing very ingenious experiments to really try to explore what an owl hears when it flies, what its prey hears when an owl approaches it. Very creative science, and really spurred, I think, just by this kind of wonder at the natural world and great curiosity.
Now, one of the things that's most interesting about the owl, and that we all know, is that it's, you know, vocalization, hoo-hoo. And about a month ago, I was standing out on my front porch at 4 a.m., kind of getting ready to take the dogs out for a walk. Mm-hmm. And I found myself in the midst of a conversation between two owls, because I could hear one on the right and one on the left. One would hoot and the other one would answer, and it went back and forth. It went on for, you know, a few minutes, and it was, then I tried to participate. I'm not the greatest imitator of owls, apparently, because nobody answered me. They kind of, they still kept talking, though. So talk about owls. And first, let's hear the sound of one of the owls you talk about in the book, Alice. It's online at the International Owl Center. Here's some sounds that she makes. So, talk about Alice and Carla Bohm, her handler.
Yeah, so owls, you know, they live in a world of darkness, many of the species, not all of them, but most of them do. And the chief way that they communicate with one another is through sound. And so when, you know, an owl hooting is really one of the few bird calls that most people know. But the truth is that a hoot is not just a hoot. The owls actually have these very elaborate vocal repertoires. And they have, you know, they have greeting hoots and territorial hoots and emphatic hoots. And they also have a range of other vocalizations. Much of this we've learned from Carla Bloom's work with Alice, who's a great horned owl. And she's a human imprinted owl, so she can't live in the wild. And when Carla first had Alice at the International Owl Center, where Carla's the director, Alice would hoot at her, and Carla would try to hoot back, but she was apparently failing, because she said that Alice would get very irritated and at one point actually swatted her because she wasn't hooting properly. So this was a spur, really, for Carla to try to understand what was going on with owl vocalizations. And it launched her into this very long-term, very detailed study of not just Alice, but also great horned owls in the wild. And what she learned is that there are 15 different kinds of vocalizations. I think there's six kinds of hoots and five kinds of chitters and four kinds of squawks. And they all carry specific meaning, and they're used in different contexts. And, you know, even like just the territorial hoot of an owl, which is what you were playing there, is Alice's territorial hoot. Those hoots are actually highly individual to the bird. So they are almost as unique as a fingerprint. And that's kind of an amazing piece of information that's really just emerged lately. And it allows scientists to do two things. They can now monitor populations more accurately by recognizing that one individual is different from another. And it's also given us a window into their social lives. You know, who's mating with whom? Who's a pair? Are they staying together, or are they actually mixing it up? And so it's been a really important breakthrough.
They were keeping some owls, human imprinted, or some, they were tracking some owls that lived in a quarry. And they named them appropriately after the Flintstones. So talk about the Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice antics of the owl.
Yeah, so this is research by Marion Savelsberg, who's in the Netherlands, and she studies Eurasian eagle owls in, as you say, a quarry. So all of her owls are named with Bam Bam and Fred and Betty, and they're after the Flintstones. But she has learned that through this, she's a musician by training. She's another one of these remarkable examples. So she uses her musical ear to tell the difference between one individual owl and another in this quarry. And it's really thanks to her research that they realized they had more than one pair. They have multiple pairs in the quarry. And interesting, what happened was that, you know, it was thought that most owls were monogamous, that they stayed mated to the same mate for pretty much all of their breeding life. But what Marion learned, and also Carla in Great Horned Owls, is this is just not the case. There's a lot of mate switching going on. Sometimes both Carla and Marion said to me, it's just, there's so much of a soap opera going on. It's just hard to keep track of the birds that you're monitoring, because one pair will then dissolve and the members of that pair will mate with other birds. And so it's a far more complex social life than we ever imagined that owls have.
You know, too, the owls, we think of them as being very solitary creatures. They might have a mate, and they might stay as a mate, but, you know, we don't think of owls that are in flocks. But you have a remarkable photograph in here of some owls in Romania that are one of the few that flock, and it's frightening almost to see so many owls together.
It is amazing. It's actually in Serbia. There are the villages of Serbia. Yeah, they have the long-eared owls gather there in colonies of hundreds. So, you know, like you, I always think of owls as the, you know, these solitary night creatures, but long-eared owls, they roost together in these very large groups. And so in the villages of Kikinda, Serbia, for instance, in this particular village, you can look up at an owl at a tree, and it will be full of owls. You know, it'll have a dozen owls in it. And the scientists think that these colonies of owls, these gatherings may actually be serving kind of as information sharing centers, that the birds actually learn from each other where the good spots are for hunting and, you know, what's dangerous and what's not dangerous. And it's remarkable. And everybody who has seen these masses of owls together is just blown away by it. Even the veteran birders, you know, they say, you just can't believe it. It's so remarkable.
You know, it's also interesting, too, how owls bring up their young. And you spend a bit of time with this. Starting with owl eggs, they're different from other birds. How are they different and why?
Well, so, yeah, the eggs of other birds, you know, you think about a chicken's egg, it's oval. And the eggs of most owls are round. And this has to do with the size of their pelvis and their flight. Birds that are, that depend on flight, they're big flyers, I think in particular of hawks and any kind of seabird. Those birds have oval eggs so that it will fit, they'll fit through the pelvis more easily. Now, the owls, they make only short flights usually. They're not long distance flyers. They're much more apt to make short hops of flights. And so they don't need this kind of narrow pelvic structure that allows for the wings that carry these other birds in flight. So their eggs can be round and.
You know, also too, owls do something different than almost any other species except humans. Their chicks will hang out kind of long after they should be able to leave. And this is a really interesting behavior. As I said, I mean, that's see that in humans and maybe, I guess, in some of the great apes. I don't know, but it's a fascinating difference for them.
Yeah, there are other birds that have these long juvenile periods when they hang out with their parents. I think in particular of the New Caledonian crow is a bird that has a long juvenile period up to 2 years where they hang out with their parents and they learn how to use tools and that sort of thing from their parents. And I was fascinated to learn that with some species of owls, for instance, the great horned, they will, and great gray, the young will stay with their parents for up to 6 months. And that's a very long juvenile period for most birds. And it is a developmental strategy that is linked with the development of intelligence. And so I was very interested to learn that some of these birds have these very long childhoods, you might call them.
You know, again, we always think, you know, birds, sky, trees, up. So burrowing owls, that just seems like so incredibly counterintuitive. What do we know about why burrowing owls chose to live in a hole in the ground, a la hobbits?
Yeah, so they, first of all, they're very widespread in the New World. So they're all over North America, South America, lots of places. They can endure very hot temperatures because they nest underground in these burrows where it's cooler. And also it's largely protected. Now, you know, there are obviously some risks. There are, skunks and all kinds of things on the ground that can take chicks. But one of the fascinating defenses that burrowing owls have developed among the chicks is that they can actually mimic the sound of a rattlesnake when they're in the burrow. So if they're cornered by a fox or a skunk or something, they make this sound that sounds exactly like the rattle of a rattlesnake. And it keeps away, fends off the predators. And sometimes the researchers who are studying these birds too, it's remarkable how they can use this mimicry.
We would be remiss to speak of owls just in terms of out in the wild, because owls have a big place in human culture. So talk about, you know, the place of the owl in human culture. They're the first bird ever pictured. We found that in a cave painting in Lascaux.
Yeah, it's actually the Chauvet Cave of France. It's 36,000 years old, and it's the what they think is the first image of any kind of bird. It's an etching, very clear etching of an owl, probably a Eurasian eagle owl or a long-eared owl. And, you know, now all over the world, owls appear in human stories as symbols, and, you know, sometimes symbols of wisdom and beneficence, good fortune, sometimes as symbols of witches and evil and omens of death. So there's a range of attitudes, but these birds have clearly lodged in our imagination in a really extraordinary way. There are scientists, ethno-ornithologists, who study the relationships between people and birds, and they have done surveys of the attitude of the occurrence of birds, different kinds of birds, in hundreds of different cultures, in their symbols and their myths and their stories. And they found that owls as a group popped way to the top in terms of occurrence. There are just many more stories and symbols with owls than with other kinds of birds. And, you know, I think it's kind of a combination of things that gives that draws us in so much to these owls. We see ourselves in them in some ways. They have these big forward-facing eyes and these round heads. And, you know, some species are actually kind of cute looking. They're very baby-like. But then also they're these creatures of the night. They're very different, otherworldly. So it's a kind of combination of this bird that's both cute and brutal, you know, familiar and strange, and kind of mysterious and uncanny. I think that's what gives them so much of their power.
How much travel did you find yourself doing to do this book, and how much were you able to do at home?
Well, it was a combination. I started working on the book during the pandemic, and it was very frustrating because my usual way of working is to get right out in the field and join the scientists, and I couldn't do that right away. So I talked to people on the phone. I did Zoom calls. I listened to some of the virtual lectures that were going on at the International Owl Center, which was great. But then I finally got out in the field, and I did quite a bit of travel and saw owls in very different areas and saw the research going on. It's my favorite part of the research is getting out in the field with people. And it was challenging for me because I'm a lark by nature. I'm not an owl. So I'm not a night owl. I like to get up early and go to bed early. So it was a stretch for me to do some of these nighttime adventures, but always worth it. And you know, just to, in some cases, I got to actually hold an owl, and it was just, you know, such a remarkable experience and had such a deep impact on me.
Now, there are owls in captivity, and Alice is among them. And so talk about, you know, the owls that are in captivity and how they got there and how owls fare. An owl is not a good pet.
Right. So I'm just going to start with the pet thing, because owls make terrible pets. And that's actually illegal to keep an owl in as a pet in the United States. They are very difficult to feed. First of all, you know, they need fresh meat, so they you know, require a fresh supply of mice or voles. Or they also have these very sharp talons, and so they shred things all the time. And you know, they poop around the house, and they're really not good pets. And all the specialists that I spoke with said, you know, really Don't even think about keeping a pet owl. But the owls that are in captivity, many of them are at wildlife rehabilitation clinics, and they've ended up there because they've had a run-in with a car, or sometimes lead poisoning. Sometimes they get poisoned by rodenticides. People try to kill rats with poison, and then the owls eat the rats, and the poison accumulates in their bodies, and they get very sick. So these owls, if they're lucky, they end up in a wildlife rehabilitation clinic, and they are nursed back to health in the best cases. And those clinics can actually then release the owls back into the wild when they're healthy. The other path that sometimes happens is that if an owl can't be released for one reason or another because it has a serious injury, or because it's been imprinted on people, that is, it doesn't realize that it's an owl. Some of the first beings that it saw was a human, and so it doesn't know how to be a proper owl in the wild. But those birds, some of them in a very small number, but they get to be, they're trained as education birds or ambassador birds. And they go into schools and communities to teach people about the lives of owls and their nature. And so the people that work with these birds, captive birds, both at the clinics and also in the training, they really get to learn things that you can only learn from an owl, you know, close up, one-on-one. You know, some of the dimensions of their intelligence, their personality, their emotions, their communication. Some really interesting insights have come out of these people who are, they just have these long-term close relationships with owls.
And one of the things too, this book is just, once again, I feel compelled to mention that. What an amazing narrative. There are some beautiful prose in this book. You have lots of fun with the owl names. And I'd like to, do you do like a final draft where you just go through and turn the prose into the beautiful, knurled, wonderful work that we get to read?
Well, thank you so much for that compliment. I work very hard on the language, and it's not just one draft. I have dozens and dozens of drafts. I work very hard combing through and I love to play with language sometimes. And it was really fun with the owl book, because I think there's a lot of vivid language that some of the owl experts use, you know, just to describe their experiences in the field. That was fun. They're also famous for their love of puns when they're naming the owls. And so it was a lot of fun to play with the language in this book and just make it as sprightly as I could.
The new book by Jennifer Ackerman is What an Owl Knows. And if you read it, you will know what an owl knows. Thank you very much for joining me, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick. It was a delight.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.